This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. This is Brittany Edmonds, and I'm very happy to be speaking with Tina Post today, whose new book, Deadpan, will be the topic of our discussion. Thank you for being here today, Tina.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I wanted to start with just, you know, because this is the first book, I wonder if you could talk to us a bit about the process of turning your dissertation into, you know, a scholarly monograph. Did the arguments change? Did the objects examined change? Did anything change? I'm sure something changed. So could you tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah, it ended up actually quite a bit changed, not so much in the conceptual framing, which remained consistent, but in terms of the arc of the argument, maybe. Right. So the dissertation was also 5 chapters, but the book is, chapter one is totally different. In both cases, it was a chapter that dealt with portraiture and sort of the most literal instances of an inexpressive face. But the sample set really changed. The argumentative stakes around that particular nugget change, which I'm happy to get into later if it's interesting. The second chapter remained mostly the same. The third is totally new. The fourth changed some. The fifth is mostly the same. And then the introduction is totally new. So what that was about, there were a couple of places where, and these were around minimalism, Black Threat, and Buster Keaton, where I was pretty certain that those argumentative moments had landed pretty well. The chapter on theatrical production, it remains, in both cases, it was a chapter about theater and excessive Blackness, stereotypical Blackness, and the kinds of evacuation that can happen strategically through that. But I do think that the argument clarified and the historical buttressing of certain visualities also increased. The biggest change, and this is sort of the most instrumental advice, the biggest changes were around the introduction, when I had the really helpful advice from Shane Vogel, who's one of the series editors. There was a reminder that many, many people only ever read the introduction of the book and maybe one other chapter if they need to. But really, you want your introduction to encapsulate your arguments in a really conveniently exportable way, so it's not just that you like allude to what you're going to do later, or that you make the first sliver of the bigger thing, but that really the introduction contains in microcosm the entire thing. So that was the biggest change, in many ways. And it's really hard to do until everything else is pretty set, right? So that was the biggest change. I was lucky insofar as my PhD advisor, who was Joe Roach, already gave permission for us to make our dissertations as close to a book as possible, which is to say a change that many people have to make is reframing their dissertations from a work that primarily demonstrates for the sake of their committee the knowledge that they've built up, and then they have to shift in the course of book editing into something that then positions themselves as the expert and has a pedagogical relation to the reader. And Joe really gave us permission. I think all of the students, he says, why wouldn't you make your dissertation as close to your book as you can? But he really gave us permission to, from the get-go, occupy a more pedagogical stance and not the stance of the supplicant, which should make the editing a little bit easier in the end. So I was lucky in that way. But yeah.
Well, thank you for that wonderfully expansive answer. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be helpful to a lot of listeners. I mean, you really kind of demystified the process that you underwent for your own book, and I know that'll be useful to other folks. I'm curious about how you sort of arrived at the concept. I mean, I know you didn't come up with this concept, but the interest in deadpan, I'll say. And I'm curious about it because I'm curious about where we might find it. You know, I know this is a performance studies book, and I kept thinking throughout sort of reading and engaging with it about whether or not it was possible to think about deadpan, you know, on the page or something, right? Or in painting, or, you know, just these other sort of media, where else might you see it? But I'm curious about just how you came to deadpan, about where we find it, and why it's a useful category to think through in cultural production, especially Black cultural production.
Right, great. Maybe I'll back up a tiny bit and say a little bit more about what I mean by deadpan, which etymologically, it's literally dead face. Pan was a slang for face. Mm-hmm. It seems to have come out of vaudeville. But as I say in the book, in a brief sort of historically rooted anecdote, there might be some reason to think that it came specifically out of the vaudeville circuit of Black vaudeville. And while I do think its comedic valences, I don't mean to exclude them, but it's not really what I take up in the book. Lots of reasons for that, not least that I think other people are better at the sonic valences that inform delivery of comedic timing and so forth. But really, I'm looking at deadpan as a gesture that's performed often through the face, but not exclusively through the face. An important framing of it that I took from a Lauren Berlant essay on Pope L is she called it showing up to withhold. And I think that, yes, you can find it in all kinds of places, because anytime anyone makes a point of showing up in order to not deliver on all the things that might be expected in that exchange, I think you can find deadpan there. The question of literary deadpan is really interesting, and I have some provisional answers, but I don't, as you say, take up the literary quite as much. But one example I think might be something like Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, where Johnson's title sort of promises a passing story. And in fact, the passing only occurs in the last couple sentences of the book. The whole book is actually about his not passing there, his years as a Black person. And then the sort of salacious passing is just the mess of pottage at the very end. So I think that's an interesting and perhaps deadpan maneuver. But I have thought less about it in the literary than in more embodied genres, including sculpture as the visual medium, the visual arts medium I take up most, in addition to portraiture. One other thing that might be useful to say quickly about it is that when I talk about deadpan aesthetics, I mean something analogous to the ways that inscrutability functions within Asian and Asian American letters, which is to say that there's this kind of key term that encompasses both broader cultural narratives of quote unquote Asian inscrutability, which may or may not actually be what's happening in any given moment. That could be an inability of the audience to see rather than something that is in fact being performed, but sometimes it's performed. And I think when I talk about deadpan aesthetics, I mean a similar nexus between cultural impressions of Black inexpression and actual performances of Black inexpression and the messy, mutually imbricating territory that exists between those two things.
Well, you know, just kind of selfishly, I'm very interested in sort of your not taking up some of the comedic valences of deadpan, especially since, you know, you say that maybe it was sort of first generated in Black vaudeville, which would have been a space where the comic or at least sort of structures of irony would have been paramount. And then even the sort of example you just gave now, Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, seems to me, or is, I mean, even in James Weldon Johnson's own words, very much a kind of cruel joke being played upon his readers. And so I wonder, he didn't say cruel, but he does say joke. But I wonder, I wonder about that. And this is a selfish sort of desire to hear what you might have to say about deadpan and its relationship to humor. So for example, your book, your introduction opens with that Rich Homie Quam meme. And, you know, that's funny to me, you know, I'm sure it's funny to you. And so, yeah, I'm a little curious, you know, and there's so many expressions of Blackness, which aren't quite in expression, but they tempt it. Like I'm thinking about the side eye or something that have entered into, you know, sort of culture writ large that are funny, right? Like there are forms of Black in expression that I think people now recognize as such, and because of that, it's taken on a kind of affect. But I do wonder a little bit about the comedic, and you said something about, well, there are other people who are more sort of attuned to comic timing, but of course, comedy could also just provide a structure, right? A structure through which a certain kind of expression is operating, a way of taking up contradiction, simultaneous contradiction or incongruity or whatever it might be, clashing affects and so forth. So I'm just curious. I don't know. I'm selfish.
No, it's a great question. And I think there's a lot to say about it. Some of it is, as I alluded to before, that, you know, you play to your strengths. And I feel like my strengths are that I'm a visual and kinesthetic thinker. And so the sample sets in my book just happen to be more visual and kinesthetic than literary or sonic or what have you. Although I certainly hope the book sets up people to take up those other things in new and exciting ways. But the other thing that I'll say is that while certainly deadpan can operate in comedic expressive realms, and the side eye is a great example, one motivation behind the book was my feeling like there were fewer tools, like a real dearth that I found sometimes frustrating to talk about inexpressive Blackness. And the comedic often tips toward the expressive Blackness that there's a ton of writing on, and it's all great and valuable. And I in no way mean to take anything away from Black joy and exuberance through this project. But I did find it frustrating that because so much of, for many reasons, for a really long time, so much of Black cultural production or expression is automatically assumed to be loud and colorful and exuberant and funny and all of these things, that whenever something operates in a different aesthetic mode, I felt like it immediately tipped into something closer to sociology. Like, what's interrupting the naturally expressive Black subject? And that the more minimal expressive registers were never taken up as expressive registers, as aesthetic registers. They were taken up as evidence of problem. And so I wanted, in part, to reclaim more circumspect aesthetic registers for Blackness. I don't think I'm the only one doing this by any means, but in that way too, I feel like attention to the comedic in some ways moves me away from that other preoccupation.
Well, I wonder if you could say something, you know, following that, about what the language of performance studies enables for this project.
Yeah, great. One thing I think, and this is also from the introduction, is that in this book, I use what I hope is a good manifestation of Sylvia Winter's practice of decipherment, which I inherited through Jose Esteban Munoz's work. I joke that all of us in minoritarian performance studies are the children of House Munoz. And I think that works well for minoritarian performance insofar as a deciphering practice, as Winter describes it, is more interested in what something does or how something works than what it means. And in order to leave some of the mystery around some of my figures, especially the historic figures who I could actually know nothing about, and I didn't want to just simply overwrite them with my suppositions of what their inexpressive thing meant, but I felt like I could, without doing that, analyze the effects of an overall aesthetic ecology within an image, within a moment of cultural production, that didn't necessarily depend on what the subject at the center of it was thinking or feeling, but that could analyze a larger scene and still say something productive about affective and emotional registers that work through the aesthetic. And I think, you know, performance studies does, it's a discipline or interdiscipline or transdiscipline or whatever you want to call it, that works well with deciphering practices for that reason. And yeah, I think especially when it comes to queer minoritarian areas where, the other thing maybe to say about this relatedly is that I don't think that in expression is necessarily a refusal of relation. Mm-hmm. After Edward Glissant's Poetics of Relation, I very much still think there can be a relation in play, but it's a relation that, you know, there's a measure of withholding or protection, or something isn't given and I don't want to just take it, if that makes sense. So I was looking for ways of respecting a degree of opacity while still engaging in what I thought was a really fascinating moment of performance or cultural production.
Yeah, no, that's really fascinating. Let's turn to your chapters. Your first chapter is titled Subjectivity and Self-Specialization. And there you take up portrait photography from the mid-19th century to the mid-20th century. So I wonder what Black in expression is doing there, and what your chapter has to tell us about it.
Great. So that chapter, I can actually give a funny anecdote about its origin. So at one point, toward the end of the dissertation, as I was trying to figure out what would get refigured, and I wrote the book mostly backwards. Like, I started toward the end of it and worked my way toward the front. And so chapter one was the last thing that I had written at the dissertation stage, and then chapter three got added later. And I, at that point, I was having a conversation with Vincent Brown, where I was talking a little bit about my writing process, which tends to be very much up from objects. I cathect to certain objects. I think something interesting is happening there. I sit with them, I write around them. And then out of amassing a bunch of those, I start to see threads, theoretical interventions that run through them. And so I'm very much not theory down, but object up toward theory. And I was describing this and he said, an empiricist. And I hope I didn't show it in the moment. I had like such a reaction of horror to that, because I think so for so many of us in Black Studies, right, like the Enlightenment is the root of a whole bunch of problems. And I very much, you know, had internalized that, but he wasn't wrong. And I knew he wasn't wrong. And so that really changed a lot of things that I was thinking about, or it deepened a lot of things I was thinking about in chapter one. And that chapter, the photographic subjects range from the 19th century to 20th century, but it also makes these forays into more early modern history to think in particular around the theorist Janice Neary called specimen logics. And her book on specimen logic, is especially around these images of insects from the early modern period. It's a fascinating book. But there are certain things in the ways that bugs come to be exemplars of the sort of specimen logic that removes something from its environment, that isolates it, that renders one specific one in great detail in order to say something about all the rest of them, that I really, we see those same logics at work in the Agassiz daguerreotypes of enslaved Black folks. And then we see essentially these same things performed in respectability photography. And as Michelle Smith has pointed out, the ways that Du Bois, with his Paris exposition, had narrated or through captioning the subjects that were meant to picture Black respectability were really sort of disarmingly consonant with the ways that eugenicists documented their own things. So at the end of the day, and this I argue in chapter one, it was perhaps always the case or recognized to be the case that the Black subject entered modernity as a sort of specimen. And the other way that Black subjects could then reclaim, maybe kind of problematically, modernity on their own terms was to perform themselves also as scientists. And really, what we see happening in the portraiture of respectability is the subject simultaneously performing the positions of specimen and scientist. And while I think that's maybe not new, I think we often pay attention to the result, like, oh, that successfully performs respectability or that doesn't. We haven't paid enough attention to the process by which that attempts to occur. So yes, that in a nutshell is chapter one.
Yeah. So for you, deadpan is crucial to that sort of that simultaneous performance of scientist and specimen. Could you say a bit more about that?
Yeah. I think that the Okay, so for one thing, there's sort of the scientific detachment that comes from the performance of in expression. There's also the realization that this is in some ways a performative that buttresses the ability of other information to come through. I talk about this a little bit in an earlier article, but when we look at portraiture, okay, so what do I want to say about this? So I think the face is the first place that we tend to look for affective or emotional information. But if you can't find your affective information within a face, what happens is not that you have no affective information. What happens is that you then gather it from other sources, right? And so if there is an inexpressive gentleman seated in an ornate chair with a Bible in one hand and a cane in another, you know plenty about him, right? But what you know comes through the cane, the Bible, the seat, not from his face. And so I think that in Black portraitures, one which, you know, maintained conventions of an expression longer than they needed to, and then also in moments like FSA photography, where documentarians dispatched in order to document the Black subject and often elected inexpressive subjects to picture. And there, I can say more about reasons for that maybe in a moment. But in both of these, what we see is strategic mobilization of the surroundings that utilize an inexpressive face in order to mount their assertions. And in some, that is, you know, the performance of respectability through props and atmosphere. Or on the other hand, many of these really well-meaning liberal artists mounted their cases around social inequality or social problematics around the Black subject by picturing them in inexpressive situations that highlighted the lack of their material surroundings. So a slightly different usage, but with this really the same operations at play.
Yeah, well, I'm curious about two things. I mean, one, you know, as you're talking, it's just tons of like a little reel of James Van Der Zee photos are going through my mind. They're always so full of things, but usually the subjects are inexpressive. But also I was curious about the sort of boundedness. Why stop at 1950 or mid-century? Does something change in Black portraiture, you know, due to sort of the beginnings of the civil rights movement? Or I'm just curious, does Black inexpression give way to something else? Yeah.
You know, I don't think necessarily, and in fact, the earlier dissertation version of this did include some Gordon Parks pictures, so later. I don't know that anything necessarily changed, although the advent of the Brownie camera and the snapshot in general changed expressive registers of portraiture, at least within the United States. And this begins to be beyond my area of expertise, but I do think on the African continent, for example, inexpressive portraiture lasted longer as a convention than the slight smile that began to creep into all of our school photos, right? I do think that there's, in the later part of the 60s and early 70s, the success, question mark, of the rights movements had also changed the way that the inexpressive subject sometimes read. There's a much larger bunch of factors at work here, and I'm not a historian, but I will say in the in boxing history, for example, which is one way that this project first came about, in the figure of Joe Louis in the 30s, his inexpression was a more or less contractually obligated subset of his performance of respectability in his manager's very concerted effort to have a non-threatening exemplar win the Black championship that had been prohibited to Black boxers since the hyper-expressive Jack Johnson earlier. But by the 70s, when we have the previously inexpressive in his younger days, George Foreman, Sonny Liston in the 60s, Frazier, in some ways, these more inexpressive figures were narrated as menacing and not simply, you know, respectable. So something that is bigger than the operations at work in this chapter did shift. I don't think it shifted entirely. Certainly, we still see inexpressive registers at work in respectability photography, but it begins to be a more fraught performative, I think.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. Well, why don't we move on to your second chapter, which is entitled Minimalism and the Aesthetics of Black Threat. And I think that's a perfect kind of segue from your talking about sort of Joe Lewis and the manager's sort of desires vis-a-vis how his image circulated. What is it about Black inscrutability? Why is it that it so often gets read as threat? And how does sort of your conception of deadpan interact with that, sort of dominant reading of Blackness?
Yeah. I don't know that I have a perfect answer for why, but I'll say it's been around for a really long time. And in that chapter, I go all the way back to Jefferson's notes on the state of Virginia, in which he talks about the troubling to him inability of Black faces to blush, and how could he possibly then understand what's going on there? And right away, it's rhetorically tied to the threat of rebellion, right? And so it's a really longstanding mess, right? And I don't have a perfect answer to it, but I do think it feels important to me to think through that. I don't know, that linkage, and also to find moments that there's chinks in the linkage. So that chapter, it takes up Michael Fried's seminal Art and Objecthood essay, in which he discusses this disdain for minimalist art, which he calls literalist art. And he doesn't like it because it feels to him too theatrical, and it feels too anthropomorphic. It calls him into relation in this way that he really doesn't like. It looms in this uncomfortable way for him. Mm. And the thing that was striking to me about Fried's diagnosis of literalist artworks aesthetic maneuverings was its consonance with the ways that Black subjects are described as, a kind of the subject-object mess that Sydney Hartman and Yuri McMillan and others have talked about, the sort of looming threat contained within the Black subject, the call to relation that is uncomfortable for the white subject. These things were all really recognizable to me from a really different context. And so I, in that chapter, then take up if minimalist artwork, if the workings of minimalist artwork are consonant with the workings of the looming Black body, how can visual arts intervene in that or nuance that in some ways? And I take up four artists in this, three Black and one white. I think, in Adrian Piper's work from the 70s, there's often a looming Black subject, but she insists on the subject's own interiority and consciousness, which Fried, of course, does not. a tribute, or like there's only maybe sort of a nefarious intention in the minimalist object, but I think Piper does really interesting work nuancing the interiority of that. Mm-hmm. I think Martin Puryear's objects loom and are minimalist in their lack of ornament, although they're beautifully handcrafted in this way that I think really diffuses any sense of threat in their looming. I think that David Hammond's works maybe do loom and maybe do contain threat, but to whom and why? So if we think of the hood that's famous from the cover of Citizen, that is generally hung at about at or above human height, there's a, I think that reads perhaps as threatening to some people, but to mm-hmm. others, I think the sort of jagged cut at the bottom of the hood, the abscension of the Black figure in between, read really differently to Black subjects, perhaps, than they do to white viewers. And then finally, I take up the figure of Robert Morris, who is a minimalist artist, and one of those minimalist artists who is considered canonical within minimalist artwork, to think about the ways that his artworks, I think, do in fact trade in a kind of Black register of an expression, including at times a substitution of his body for what had in other artworks been a Black figure. Sorry, was the answer really long?
No. Okay. I'm just also looking at the images as you speak. And so, you know, I have your book sort of printed out. And so I'm just looking at images as you speak. What I was curious about is, you know, you began our conversation talking about your interests and what, and the sort of, in the process, right? The aesthetic process of deadpan. And so across these artists, I'm curious what deadpan does in relationship to this idea of Black inscrutability as threat. And you've said that a little bit in your answer already, but I wonder if you could give us another gloss on that just for listeners. Yeah.
I think what's important about the artworks that I choose is that all of them mobilize an aesthetics of looming in some ways. And looming is really the embodied sense of threat that that Fried picks up on. And I'll say in my chapter, I do a little work to say by threat, I mean threat in the sense that Brian Massumi uses threat. And in that, importantly, threat isn't real or actualized and can't be and still be threat, because threat is this anticipatory affect that surrounds the impression of a danger that has not yet arrived and can't arrive. And because if it does, then it's something other than threat, right? And so in mobilizing the terminology of threat, I don't mean to suggest that the Black figure is ever actually, in fact, a container of danger, because I don't think they are, but I think the impression that they are is the thing that that is persistent in the wreaks violence on Black bodies all the time. So if looming is the embodied container of this thing called threat, then where can we find artworks that in some ways perform looming or loom? And then how do they nuance what looming is or what looming enacts? And again, to use maybe Puryear as an example, because I just love his work so much. They're big. Some of them are vaguely, they contain shapes that imply subjectivity. So they'll be vaguely head shaped or something, but they feel monumental. They're, I'm not a large person, but they're as big as I am and much wider. You know, they are not small objects. And one of the things that Robert Morris talks about in his notes on sculpture is the ways that like small objects call bodies into intimacy, right? Like you want to touch, pick up, like play with little things. These are not little things. They call your body into relation with that body in a certain kind of way. So they might be, in fact, kind of looming things. But again, when I look at a Puryear sculpture, these are beautiful, self-contained, highly wrought, beautifully finished works that I at least can't even begin to sense how anyone would find them threatening. I find them so like placid, and I want to be with them in a different kind of way. So so for Puryear, just to, I think all these artists do a different thing, but with Puryear, I would say he reclaims the prerogative of an object to loom while diffusing any sense of threat that's contained in it.
No, that's great. No, thank you. Thank you for humoring me there. Yeah, folks will have to pick up your book to see what you say about David Hammond's very much circulated in the hood kind of piece of artwork. But let's move on to chapter three. You said this is one of the new chapters that you drafted just for this book, and it's called sort of opacity gradient. And so I wonder what you could talk. You use this phrase that I like. You said you attempt to parse aesthetics of calibrated visibility and withholding by thinking through discrete points of visual saturation. So tell us about the opacity gradient.
Yeah, great. So this is this came about because you know, I mentioned earlier feeling like sometimes there's really this dearth of vocabulary or ways of talking about more circumspect registers of Black aesthetics. And one place that I think we see this, and for such good reason, I want to reiterate, I think there's really good reasons for all the things that that I'm trying to push on a little bit. But on the one hand, through the really important work of Daphne Brooks and others, we have this sort of opacity, this really difficult to discern, sort of confounding Black subject who is present, but in some ways interrupts our ability to know them, and really important. On the other hand, we have fugitivity, where the Black subject just like absconds, they disappear. But I think for, again, really good reasons, the field of Black studies in general operates with constant reference to these two poles, opacity, fugitivity. And gosh, I just felt like there has to be a bunch of stuff in between those two things, right? And so this was my attempt to parse out what some of those things might be. So I think on the one hand, we have performances of really dense presence. And my example for that is Simone Lee's beautiful, again, monumental sculptures. And then on the other hand, something that I'm calling transparency, not in the way of Glissant's transparency, by which he means something like self-evidence. But what I mean is when actually you're right there and nobody sees you, they just see right through you. Interestingly, the figure who I used to locate that is choreographer, dancer, actor, Cheryl Sutton, who was everywhere for a moment and seems to have been completely forgotten. Not completely forgotten, she was not that long ago on stage in another Robert Wilson piece, but I don't think she has, we haven't given her her flowers and she deserves them. But as these writers around Robert Wilson's work, she did a bunch of independent choreography. She performed in Paris and at the Sculpture Garden in MoMA. She performed alongside Min Tanaka and Trisha Brown, just all these really critical figures. There's a book written about her by this like Czech artist. She was everywhere for a moment. The ways that this one author describes it, and other people said essentially the same thing, but he said, you know, everyone who Robert Wilson worked with had a shtick, and hers was sort of floating or gliding, that she could move so slowly that you couldn't see her moving or something, that you could look right through her into the ocean behind. I don't know exactly how this performative works, but I do realize that there's a an accrual of consonant descriptions. And I think in general, those of us who are racialized recognize the ways that these, like the most transparent and the most dense performances maybe kind of bend around closer to one another again, but there is a difference in feeling between someone seeing you and taking you for granted and someone looking right through you like you're not there at all, right? Sometimes there it's a subtle difference, but it's a difference. And I think those are the extreme points on either end. And then between them, and again, I use visual artworks to help me parse these techniques, but there's something that's like sheerness. There's something that's like obscurance. And then there's something that's sort of away. And some of the artists, I generally have a couple of touchstones in each of these, but obscurance, I talk about the ways that Titus Kaphar sort of pictures, but often as something kind of occluding his Black subject. For awayness, I talk about Lorna Simpson and the ways that there's often like the back of a Black subject or a sort of a subject who often words will narrate in some ways their presence, but they're not stroscopically available. And sheerness I locate in a couple of different artists, but that's the broad strokes of that chapter.
That's great. You know, while you're speaking, and I think this will lead us into chapter four, which is titled Excess and Absence, or the Negro Believes, and then there's a sort of blank. I think this will lead us into that, but I'm curious about kind of in expression that's through a kind of very glossy form of expression, which I think is you know what I mean? Because, you know, as you've been speaking about how people sort of respond to various forms of Black in expression, they also respond that way to Black laughter, right? It's unreadable to most people. And that unreadability is it's what's discomforting about Black laughter. And so maybe that'll lead us into chapter four, and you can unfold what it is you want to tell us about the stage.
Sure. The two works I take up there, one was written by the Korean American playwright Young Jin Lee, but together with her all Black ensemble cast. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that it was a participatory process of devising. And then Neighbors by Brandon Jacobs Jenkins, which I'm not going to remember the exact quote, but he basically said, like, I didn't ever expect this work to be performed. Both of these are works that incorporate pretty directly conventions of minstrelsy in different ways. Young Jin Lee sort of takes that tripart subject of the minstrel stage that coalesced around the 1840s with an opening dance number and then a skit-based thing and then a longer dramatic plantation scene, but she makes it into a parlor drama. Black stereotype runs throughout that work. Similarly, Brandon Jacobs Jenkins has this work in which the Crow family, who are minstrel performers played by Black actors in blackface, they move in next to a biracial family. Father is Black, mother is white. There's a biracial daughter. The father is a classics professor at a university. And then interfamilial tension unfolds between what kind of Black people these are or want to perform to be. And meanwhile, the play is interspersed with these sort of interludes of just the performances of the most over the top racial stereotype imaginable by the Crow family. And what struck me with both of these works is the ways that Blackness as staged is so excessive as to sort of self-evacuate. and like the minimalist artwork where there was a essay from a Coben Immerser volume several years ago by a woman named Angeline Morrison, who talks about the ways that There are a few stock responses to monochrome. One is to say that there's nothing there, and the other is to search out some tiny bit of differentiation and claim that that's the thing that's important. And there's a long history of the monochrome mobilizing essentially jokes about the unseeability of blackness in darkness. And so reading, again, the sort of visual arts conventions out of monochrome and the sort of excessive evacuation that can happen in these plays argue that, there is a way, and I think it can misfire. I should say that too. It can misfire. But I think there's a way in which excessive performances of stereotype that are so bombastic, so over the top, can sort of, at the end, they start to mean nothing. Like they don't, there's no meaning there. That thing that you're showing me isn't a thing that I can recognize as actual blackness. I'm interested in the workings there. Now, there's no guarantee that every audience member is going to get there. But I think they take great pains to make everything so excessive that it's very likely. I'll say too that part of the way I realized this, I opened the chapter with this, is early days when I would tell people, I'm working on Black inexpression, people would over and over again say, like, ah, yes, we wear the mask, which is a poem that, but the first line of that is, we wear the mask that grins and lies. So there's expression built in from the first, but somehow this, something happens, right, where we take the mask and then everything that happens underneath it, we forget how much emotion was there or something. But there's a really interesting play that I think can occur.
So yeah, I'm just curious if you could say just a tiny bit more about this kind of self-evacuation that's happening, because you're saying nothing's there, and you mean that in the sense of like a Black subjectivity or a Black subject. So that evacuation is being mobilized to do some other kind of work, or is it being mobilized to, I'm just curious about how you're reading that.
Certainly, I'd say in terms of Black subjectivity, there's, what's the best way of explaining this? So, perhaps even as big as the racial category writ large, that everything that we think it's rooted in, you double down on it, it becomes absurd. It manifests in these plays, most particularly through the sort of container of character. So what is the racial construction writ large, and what is the individual subjectivity's manifestation of it, is perhaps a little harder to parse. That's maybe an open question of the chapter that I don't think I get to the answer how big that, what are the outer limits of that evacuation, but I think they certainly have the potential to speak to really large, really large constructions of racialization, and not merely the character subject.
Yeah, I mean, you know why I ask is because, you know, I do know, I've actually seen some of Brandon Jacob Jenkins's work, and you know, there's blackface or whiteface and all of it. There's always sort of absurd. I mean, I know you know this. And so, you know, I guess I don't know what I think about his work yet in terms of what it means, you know, and I know that's not what you're after in this book, but I was curious because there's sometimes when, you know, I've seen The Octoroon is the play that stands out most in my mind because I've seen it most recently. And yeah, I mean, like, there are times when the enslaved people are in on the joke, and there are times when they're the butt of it. And then, you know, and so I was just curious if you had a read about that line between the sort of excessive blackness sort of tipping into sort of a kind of evacuation, but maybe doing this other kinds of critical work vis-a-vis, like you said, constructions of race or sort of apprehension, that even just sort of intervening in the process of apprehending race as such, right? Of recognizing blackness that's not sort of phenotypic. I don't know. I was just curious if you had things for that.
Yeah, maybe one other thing I'll say about that ever so briefly is that both of those plays incorporate, as does the Octoroon, in a slightly different way, but they incorporate moments of sort of direct audience address. So it isn't merely what you see unfolding on the stage that is that you can look at that and say, oh, isn't that an interesting critical intervention, which it is. But there are moments where the actors turn around and look right at you, mm-hmm. you sitting in the seat, which in the U.S., of course, majority white audiences, but not exclusively and whatever. And so there's always this sort of maybe at most generous invitation and at least generous accusation or something about and so now what? And you seated there who are, so I think that to me is a really important component of the kind of intervention and kind of evacuation that happens is that it mm. isn't, the audience is not allowed to passively consume what mm. happens. I think the Octoroon or an Octoroon is especially multivalent in that the moments of audience invitation offer a wealth of ways in, some of which are deeply troubling. But I think in that case, I've written a little bit about this in an article that takes up an Octoroon and Underground Railroad game. But that in those cases, audience members are really invited to watch each other as well as the stage. I think that's less the case with The Shipment and Neighbors. I think that's more, an individual address to you in the seat, a sort of check-in with your feelings and intellect, not so much the observation of one another. But I think in either case, the moment of audience address is an important component of it.
Okay, well, thank you. I'll have to check out your An Octoroon essay, and I'm happy to know about it. Your final chapter is entitled Buster Keaton's Black Deadpan. So tell us about that.
Yeah, great. So Buster Keaton was a film star of the silent film era. His heyday was around 1928, I want to say. And he grew up performing his family had a troupe, the three Keatons, and he performed on medicine show stages, sort of traveled around. All of his biographies and autobiographies are full of lore, some of which is probably true, some of which is probably not, but supposedly Harry Houdini nicknamed him Buster after he fell down a flight of stairs or something, and it's that kind of book. His family did in fact travel with the Houdinis for a bit, but so that era of stage production is of course one in which minstrel conventions were wide, and there's pictures of his father in blackface. And then later on in his career, there's pictures of Keaton in blackface as well. But what I'm most interested in is not the moments where he adopted a black persona through blackface. And he also performed other racial caricatures. But moments that he, I think, adopted what was recognizable as a cultural perception of Black embodiment. And what I mean by that in particular is sort of doubled insensibility that was both rooted in the physical insentience of supposed physical insentience of Blackness, such that Black people could be hurt without consequence, that it wouldn't really hurt them all that much. Still see this in the doctor's office, right? It hasn't gone anywhere. And also their sort of intellectual insentience that they, maybe it takes you 5 seconds to yell ouch because your brain's so slow to register that it doesn't. And that also his inexpressive face allowed that sort of double down on the sense that he could be thrown around, that he could like enact all these ridiculously dangerous stunts with no real consequence, that it didn't hurt, that it didn't that he, like staged blackness, could perform what Robin Bernstein and her excellent book Racial Innocence takes up with the Raggedy Ann doll, whose roots were the Scarecrow from The Wizard of Oz, which was best known to Americans through the stage. And I think that that same stage lineage of Black minstrel indestructibility and insentience, in fact, informs his sort of deadpan performances.
Oh, that's excellent. All right. Well, thank you so much. I want you to leave us with just one last nugget before we sort of close out the interview. So is there anything else you want to tell listeners about deadpan or about your work? Feel free.
Oh, gosh, that's a big question. I don't know. It's the book is still pretty new. So I know you said, too, that there's an opportunity to help reframe things, but I'm still excited to learn how it will land. I think I've done just two or three book talks, one online that was a class visit, and then two sort of in the world. I'll tell you about my book. So it's still kind of early days, but I'm excited about it. It was a joy to write. I hope it lands well. I don't know. Do you have any other questions about it?
No, I mean, I think you have. I mean, one of the things I'm curious about, and I do hope that people invite you to come talk about this book, is just your kind of wonderfully expansive archive. I mean, I know you're sort of in the world of performance, but even there, I mean, you are in a bunch of different performance spaces. And so it would be lovely to hear about how you arrive at your objects. I know you gave us a kind of a preview of that by saying you're an object up person and you're just kind of drawn to things. But I will say that I was pretty impressed and amazed by just the breadth of your archive in this book.
Thank you. Maybe one other thing I can say about that, because some of it is, as I said, sort of intuitive, right? Like you just, there are things that you respond to. And I am a believer in, I'm going to butcher the quote, but there's a wonderful old Martha Graham quote about how like no one else sees the world or can enter the world in the way that you can, because we're all these unique beings, and that's really where our strength lies. And so, I do think it's important that we connect to what we connect to, and we should, you know, take up whatever that is and then figure out why. I have never really fought my intuition about, oh, there's something here. But it's also the case that, a student was asking me about, my bibliography is kind of bonkers. I just like, it's people from everywhere. But the thing with that is, I think I have a pretty instrumental relation to theory. There are those theorists that you hold close, you know, like I think anyone coming out of Black studies, we all, you know, Du Bois is in there. I'm pretty Foucauldian. Like there are these people that just like, they are your deeply held people. But after that, I tend to have a pretty instrumental relationship to theorization, which I think is often not pretty dispositional. And so you figure out, here's this object that I think I see something in. And the thing that I think I see is X. Who else sees kind of like this ever in anything, right? And then they become part of the theoretical posse that you bring to a particular object. So that can lead anywhere. And then also, as with any scholar, like, right, you read the thing that you're drawn to, and then you find the footnote or the one other image that you chase down, and that opens a whole other world. And so there's a measure of that serendipity as well. But I do just think I couldn't do anything other than have a sort of chaotic relationship to source and to theory. And I just want to bring it all in and throw it all together and see what happens.
I was going to say expansive, not chaotic, expansive.
Thank you.
But I do have another kind of bonus question. And just because you just name-checked Du Bois, and I'm curious, you know, I ask this question of my students all the time, and I ask it of close friends or scholars that I just happen to be in long conversation with. I'm curious about what you think about double consciousness in our present moment, if it's still sort of a useful way to capture sort of Black consciousness and its instantiation in this country. And then I'm curious about it in relationship to deadpan, because I find that, I'll just say that first, and I've gotten wildly different responses to this question. But yeah, I'm curious what you might say, just because you said his name, and I'm so surprised to hear you say him in relationship to your work, to be honest. So,
oh, interesting. Yeah. I mean, I do think that the sort of self-specimenization of chapter one is very in line with the Du Boisian view of like yourself, and then yourself as other people see you. And I think, you know, the answer to its overall relevance, you know, it probably a little bit depends, and probably already always has a little bit depended. I will say it was absolutely part of my own upbringing, like deeply held, right? Like, I think that, like, yeah. Yes.
yeah.
Yes. And I do think, like, that, you know, every once in a while, as I say in some footnote somewhere, you know, every once in a while has its sort of, you know, you were raised Black when jokes. And one of those is always about, like, fix your face. And fix your face is nothing but a Du Boisian, like, other people see you, right? Like, and yeah. So I do think it, for me, it still weighs heavily. Now, I do think there are probably people whose upbringing or whose, what do I want to say, whose upbringing or whose disposition, for lack of a better term, is less conscripted by respectability politics. But the thing that I'll say about that too is maybe, but once it's in there, I don't know how to get it out again.
Okay. Yeah, I guess.
And you know,
yeah.
I think I can be self-aware and be like, oh, this is that. But I think it's a really hard, if it's second sight, I think it's a really hard vision to lose. It just gets in there.
Huh. Well, that'll be something I'll have to ask you post the interview about then. But thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks so much for having me.